Welcome to the Signals Podcast, a monthly transmission of future frameworks for cross-cultural design. I am your host, Elijah Vargas. To build a more inclusive, accessible, and global digital future, we need new frameworks for technological development. Every month, Signals broadcasts insights from visionaries at the forefront of creative inquiry and design innovation about how emerging technology can support cross-cultural connection. What do cultural production and co-creation look like today? What about in 2050? What does cultural exchange mean in the digital age? How do technocultures contribute to or corrode a shared global cultural exchange? How can the nascent technological domains of artificial intelligence, extended reality, big data, and Web3 contribute positively to the planet? Can technocultural exchange tackle the pressing crises of climate change, xenophobia, assault on women's rights, and the crisis of imagination facing the world today? From the San Francisco Bay Area and beyond, these are some of the questions we will tackle. The initiative Sea Change is implemented by the Goethe Institute San Francisco in cooperation with Gray Area and funded by the Foreign Office of the Federal Republic of Germany. My guest today is A.M. Dark. A.M. Dark is an assistant professor in digital arts and new media, critical race and ethnic studies, and performance, play, and design at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Thanks so much for joining me on the Signals Podcast, A.M. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me. The reason I shook my head is there's an update to that little bio. I got tenure, so I'm an associate professor.
Hey, all right. That's serious. Nice job.
Yeah, thanks. Maybe it changes what I can and will say in today's discussion.
There are disciplining practices abound, I think. Well, you know, that is such a great framing for this very first question that I have for you. Also on your website, you describe yourself as an artist and scholar designing radical tools for social intervention. I'm curious how games operate for you as a platform for radical social intervention, and maybe even more so as a tenured faculty member. Does that change what that means for you at all?
You know, it's funny. When I first got tenure, because I got tenure early, it's usually a 7-year process at my institution. And in the fall, I go back to teaching in about 3 weeks. It'll be my 4th year there. So, you know, it was a really big, it felt like a really big accomplishment. And being a queer Black woman, femme presenting person, that felt like the odds were already stacked. And so it really felt good to get there. And I was telling, you know, some friends, it's like, oh, well, now I can do whatever I want. And my friends, like all of them across the board, were like, yeah, but you were already doing that. And I was like, oh. There is, of course, a material change because that security, I say security with a little bit of scare quotes because, you know, in our society, there are so many things that, you know, are presented as stable, but then can be easily taken away. I'm not thinking of Roe versus Wade right now. Anyway, what I felt was a kind of relief and a little bit of self-pride that I was able to hit that milestone and do it my way, that I didn't wait to be radical until I had the security. But what I've seen, especially UC Santa Cruz, because, you know, since I've been there, I think I had one calm year and then it was like wildfires, graduate student strike. You know, we were out there protesting and marching for months. I mean, I was and other, you know, faculty were with grad students who were striking for a cost of living adjustment because of the astronomical prices in the Bay Area, as you know, as we both know. And then that was only interrupted by a pandemic. And so it's like so much happened in such a short amount of time. And one of the things that it revealed to me was that the people who have the privilege and the safety to speak the loudest don't. And in a lot of ways, I understand that because I feel like so much of my life is like, I want to be safe and I want to be comfortable and I want to be happy, and why get into things? But the structural systems that we're working with really incentivize being quiet and giving you crumbs of comfort So it really meant something to me. It's become like a point of pride, I guess, that I didn't wait. I did those things. And fortunately, because it is fortune, that I was still recognized by some folks who also had some power and wanted to use it in radical ways. That's sort of what I'm processing, that feeling that I've never been grateful, even though I'm expected to be, that I always want more. And I want that more because I deserve it. And that's also how I feel about others. And what can that work do? So now that I do have this privilege and this power, am I using it well? How will I use it in the future? How will I use it to expand the space as opposed to kind of like hold it close to me because I got my little crumb and now, you know, don't want to lose it? Yeah, that's what I've been thinking about.
You're making me want to dive into some of the things that I was planning to get to in our conversation like 45 minutes in, but I think I need to raise them now. I mean, firstly, congratulations for all of that. That's fantastic. And how lucky UCSC is to have you. You know, I was playing, I don't know if playing is quite the right word. I was engaged with Fairly Intelligent. And at some point in the algorithm that you have made, the Fairly Intelligent algorithm, which perhaps you could frame for people as an introduction after I ask you this question, there's a point in it where you talk about Ruha Benjamin and the New Jim Code, as well as algorithms of oppression, which I'm not as familiar with the writer of.
Sophia Noble.
Thanks. At the end of the game, I mean, you kind of lay into, like, throughout, again, I called it a game, and I don't know, I'll let you define it.
I mean, I refer to it as a speculative fiction.
Right.
That's presenting itself as a game, that's presenting itself as a survey, that's presenting itself as like a populist, you know, call to action. So yeah, my category, just like my gender is chaotic, so are all of the categories in which I work. So it's fine if it's none of those things or all of those things to you.
Oh, I mean, and I think like my main question that I have for you about it, which is not what I'm getting at now, but really what it has me thinking about the whole time is like the aesthetic choices that you made around it. I mean, they're so... it's so well composed and it's so full of snark. And that's just, for me, part of why it renders itself so well. I can't wait to hear more about that. But I want to ask you this thing about Ruha Benjamin, because I really am inspired by Ruha Benjamin's idea of a third way of knowledge production. She says there needs to be a third way for knowledge production that is not entirely fact and not entirely fiction, because facts alone are not enough. And this becomes her kind of radical call to an anti-racist world-building practice. And you don't talk about the third way in the game, but you talk about all of the ways that a third way becomes possible. And it made me think about your interactions you might have with your students, which is why I want to get to this question now, because you're talking about tenure and you're talking about this institutional process. And I wonder how you maintain that way of being yourself as an educator and as a mentor, and how you steward a third way. Like, this is what I was thinking about the whole time I was playing the game. So I think it's just really advantageous that you started off by talking about your relationship to the institution.
Yeah, I mean, thank you for bringing that back up too, because I'm like, I started to get chills. I mean, I really admire Ruha. She's so knowledgeable. Her writing is so good. It's so informative. But what I really love is that the way that she writes is beautiful, right? Like, she really illustrates her points. It's so vivid. It's so visual. I also like that her books are dense, but don't feel that way. They feel very accessible. So, you know, it's like you have the New Jim Code, and what is the sort of subline is like, abolitionist tools for da 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 da. And it's like, you read that book and you think you're just reading a book about tech. And then it's like, insert, this is like a definition of abolition. But she doesn't sort of sidebar you, and she doesn't make you feel like, oh, well, you don't know. She just kind of, she has this rhetorical trick that I've employed sometimes, but not as skillfully, which is talking to your audience as if they already agree with you. And you're just over explaining a little bit. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, of course you're an abolitionist. Of course you don't believe in the existing social structures. Of course you think we need to burn this down and build something else. But I'm not going to labor over that part about the potential. I'm not even going to give you the space to kind of argue with me there. I'm just going to be like, of course, because this is what a reasonable, thoughtful, compassionate person would feel. So I'm going to say it. And also I'm just going to explain it in case there was just, you know, just maybe someone standing next to you that you would have had to explain it to. And so you kind of go through that process that you're like, oh, I'm just looking at tech. And you're like, have I been abolitionist enough? Do I have some problematic stuff? Oh, did I think about the ways that this was operating? And she kind of gives you that space to save face while also being in alignment. I know that's a tangent. This is part of what I do, tangent. But I was thinking about that because I'm often thinking about the how, right? The how to communicate the point in a way that is not preachy, in a way that is generous, in a way that is informative, in a way that feels human and social and non-hierarchical, and that assumes the best about the folks that I'm speaking to. So this is all very connected for me. So I'm trying to weave around a few different points, but I'm thinking about one thing you said is why games, and or not why games, but that's often the question we get. But how do games fit into this? Now I'm a tenured professor. Okay, how do I interact with students? And I think the answers are all very similar, including why I think about Ruha's work and how Fairly Intelligent was so around this, me sort of consuming the things she was talking about. I'll start with games. People think that games are about code and visuals, maybe sound, aesthetics, mechanics, all these different things, and about rules, that's the medium. The medium for games is people. It's not on the other stuff. You are just putting people in a situation and you're kind of, I was tweeting about this today, you're sort of pressing buttons and pulling levers and seeing what people do with that, how they're going to respond. And people are my interest. Like, that's what I care about. It doesn't really care about the media, but like, so I think a lot about how to communicate. I think a lot about what environment we need to be in. How do you prime an audience? How do you put someone sometimes in a physical space to receive a message? How to put them in an emotional space to receive a message? Because I tend to look at the world like, I assume most people are good. And I assume that I'm not really smarter than anyone. And this is a mixed bag, because if you ever follow me, half of my things are like, I'm so smart. Everyone's annoying, gets on my nerves. Like, I have to vent. But because of my background, you know, at 18, I had a 9th grade education. I didn't finish high school. I came from poverty. I was a smart kid in that sense. I had ambitions for school, but I kind of like, school was the only way that I knew for social mobility or to get out. And when I was taken out of high school, I just felt like, well, I'm just stupid now and I have no path forward. And I've had a really sort of winding road of just life experience. I've crossed so many different social strata, and that's been such a core learning experience to me, which is different than existing from a certain position or having a certain viewpoint or growing up in a home with a certain set of books or with a certain community, or even in absence of a certain community and then having to kind of learn about them from afar, from some sometimes saviorist-y moral position or whatever. And so because of all that, basically what I'm trying to say, because for most of my life, I had really low self-esteem and assumed I just didn't know anything. When I realized that I had certain insights and certain things clicked for me about how the world worked, compassion and empathy for people that I didn't immediately identify with, understanding that, oh, someone who's doing that isn't stupid. They are actually making the best choice they have with the knowledge that they have, or maybe they've come to a conclusion that I disagree with or think is harmful, but I don't want to pretend like there isn't a basis for that conclusion, which is something we often do. It's like, oh, well, you're just a bad person. It's like, no, people have experiences that inform the way that they behave in the world. And all of that is to say, when I'm engaging with anyone that I feel responsibility for, and that's students, but that's also an audience, because again, the nature of games is constructing an environment. It really is a vulnerable thing. I'm asking you to be in a place and to trust that place is safe. It's very literal if we talk about things like escape rooms or alternate reality games where you're in the real world. It's like, I might be asking you to cross the street. I might be locking you in a room and you just have to trust that I'm not, you know, don't have a nefarious plan. But also emotionally, you know, or if I'm teaching, if I'm using rhetoric, I'm also asking you to trust that I'm not trying to turn you into a Nazi, for example, which I can't say for all games. So I tend to look at everyone and think, well, if someone has a different conclusion than I have, especially over something that could be harmful, right? Then I need to create the conditions so that they can see sort of through my eyes, right? I have to create, you know, I have to create the environment. I have to maybe limit some things. I have to shape it. I have to give them the information. I have to give them a scenario. And I can't tell them, like, I can't, like with my card game objective, it's like the first major project I finished in undergrad. It's like 12 years old or something now. This is a project that's all about beauty standards and colorism and how race and gender inform how we, like, the politics of desire, really. And I don't say all that. Instead, it's just a card game with a bunch of illustrated pictures of women. And there's some like race swapping going on, but you don't immediately know, where it's like, oh, it's the same face, but just their hair color and their eyes or whatever have been changed. And it plays like a party game and you're talking, you're hanging out and you're like, oh, who's the most attractive? It's like, oh, okay, it's your turn. I'm playing all these women's faces. Who do you find attractive? Let's talk about it. Let's argue about it, you know, over some beers or whatever. And it's fun and it's light, but then it's not. But then you have these moments of reflection. You have these moments of like self-consciousness that why did I find the person with the lighter skin more attractive when it's the exact same thing? Or why do I always pick the person with curly hair or whatever? And what I did with that was I was like, I just need to control the data. I cannot tell someone, hey, Black women are good looking and you're probably attracted to them. Because first of all, Black women are very diverse. There's a lot of diversity within Blackness itself. What you think of as Black might just be because you've seen magazine spreads or popular media, and there's only ever one kind of Black person and they're a token. Or there's two kinds of Black people. There's the Beyonce, European eyes, light skin, palatable, sex symbol, fetish Black woman. Or there's the Viola Davis circa 2011, where it's like the desexualized mammy figure servant role. And that's all you think Black is. And you don't even know what it can look like and the possibilities of that. Or maybe you're not used to just embedding yourself in a Black world, right? Where you're not making these comparisons, or you're not having these sort of snap judgments when you see a Black person, just assume that they're not part of your social circle, and therefore they become like not really a person you're looking at. So I kind of had all of these insights and these intuitions that were informing that work and that inform all of my work. And so I think, okay, how did I get there? How did I cross the threshold from having a very mainstream informed, stereotypical, uncritical response to a social situation or a social dynamic, especially dynamics of power, to really having that aha moment of, wait a minute, this didn't come from my mind. This isn't who I am. This is just something that I just happened to consume and never thought about because it's so normalized. So constructing that environment and assuming that people just, that I'm like not smarter or better, that I just happened to stumble on a particular context that was able to teach me something in a different form than I would have expected. And that's where all my work comes from. And that's how I treat students. You know, you talked about mentorship, and I'm like, I literally said this to a friend yesterday. We were talking about age gaps in a variety of relationships, whether they were romantic relationships, which has its own structural issues and can have power dynamic problems, or even friendships, like what it means to have young friends. And I was saying that, you know, as a teacher, I of course have a different view here because I am in a role of responsibility to students. And I even have students that are older than me, but kind of when I'm a professor, when I'm in that teaching position, everyone's like, oh, sweet baby, sweet summer child. Even like tall, you're taller than me, you're older than me, it doesn't matter. I'm just like, oh, my babies. But that even though it starts that way, my goal is always to make for there to be a possibility of friendship, right? Because I want all of my students to know ultimately, like, yeah, we're in this period of time where I'm giving you something, but that's just one data point to fold in as you develop your own worldview. And I'm never going to sort of lord my position over you. You're a thinking, feeling person who already has knowledge, who I am learning from, who I want to learn from, who I want to build a world with, because we kind of need each other. And I think if you take that approach of like always trying to flatten a hierarchy, which doesn't mean ignoring that they exist, but trying to do what you can to reach this kind of equilibrium where everybody feels safe and competent and like they don't have all of the answers, but can actively engage in like this kind of reciprocal learning, then that feels really good. And we get to grow and maybe we get to build something better.
I had a dog open the door somehow.
I just opened a door for a cat. So that was
there you go. Make this conversation a little bit more multi-species.
Yeah.
I mean, I take a lot of your playful antics that are extraordinarily playful, but at the same time, like super critical and super serious as a part of that method for creating a horizontal atmosphere. I just completely lost the question I was going to ask you.
That's okay. You want a moment?
It's the nice thing about recording in advance. this moment will go away.
No, see, I think this moment should stay in.
Okay.
Because this is important to, this is what I think about live space. So you asked how am I myself? Being myself takes a lot of active work because so much about my life and living has been, don't be yourself. And that's, I think, kind of a universal thing. It doesn't apply to maybe every single person. And we know who those people are because they move through the world oblivious and they're very annoying. But they seem like they have good mental health. So good for them. But like, it takes a lot of work to show up as your full self in a world that really much incentivizes and like oppresses in such a way that you might even know who that full self is. That's kind of the hardest part. It's like once you sort of accept the space. So the reason I say this should stay in is because I've really been pushing back against that desire for me to be perfect or to only show up in like this kind of aestheticized version of being flawed. Because I'm like a pro at turning vulnerability into an aesthetic. It's like a decoy. It's like, I'm going to be vulnerable in this way that you think is vulnerable, but doesn't really mean anything to me. And then that feels relatable and it's safe. And then we don't have to unpack all this stuff over here. And I have been working really hard. I'm still in it. I've been doing like a 3-month long ongoing anti-performance on social media, but also in real life. It was one of those ideas that I was like, this is probably stupid and I'm going to say stupid things and I'm going to be a stupid person. And for someone like me, that's like the worst thing. That's so embarrassing. Oh God, the idea I could get something wrong in public and everyone would see it. And then I don't know, my world would crumble because being smart and competent is the only thing that I have that my self-esteem is built upon. Ah. And then I'm like, I'm glad that I forced myself to do it even through my initial and sometimes flares of discomfort, because what I have learned by, I'll call it what it is, unmasking, both IRL and in the virtual space, I have learned so much in a rapid amount of time, because you learn more from when you're experimenting and you can mess up. Like you learn more from the things that create friction. You know, if you look through some of my work and interviews in the past couple of years, you'll see this phrase that I've started to move toward. I'm like, oh, like I want to have a liberatory praxis. Which, you know, I'm borrowing a little bit from bell hooks, but this idea that, at least for, I'll define what it means for me. A liberatory praxis means that you're not just making work that you think will liberate, which can sometimes involve suffering, especially if you're doing around work around like race and gender, and you're a part of the group that's being oppressed, and you're like, oh wow, I really have to put my whole stuff on display here, and it's hard, and people don't understand, and yada yada yada. But when the process itself, the actual making of the work is liberatory. That was like, oh my God, because what happens there is that you've already succeeded because you are freeing yourself. It's not a sort of the means justifies the ends. I'm going to suffer now, but then I'm going to get this amazing award and everyone's going to understand blackness, all of blah, blah, blah. No. So what I've learned thinking about that liberatory praxis, I kept having that phrase, but I don't think I was doing it. I kept having to remind myself, like, wait, why am I feeling sad? Why am I upset? Why am I stressed out? That's not praxis. That goes back into, I'm just using the language. That's the aesthetics of liberation. That is not, I need to feel this. And so by doing this experiment and going to these places that were genuinely scary and required real vulnerability and required being okay with looking stupid, with looking silly, with looking frail, with looking vulnerable, with looking like I didn't have things together, and not in a cute Instagrammable way, but in a real, like, you know, kind of embarrassing way. I have never felt more free or more fulfilled at any point in my life. So that's the feeling. That's the internal subjective experience. Also, materially speaking, structurally speaking, even like in my observable things, my life is demonstrably better. Just things rapidly changed in terms of the way that I, like my partnerships, my interactions with other people, opportunities that I had, just everything got better. So yeah, I'm a real advocate for like, don't aestheticize it. Let's have all the little bits.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that, and tend to find a lot of optimism maybe in the messiness in that respect also. I mean, I think the kind of the teaching to transgress bell hooks thing that you're talking about is, I think, super. That is like a kind of revelatory, particularly in any kind of teaching atmosphere, which isn't just, of course, taking place in an academic context at all. I mean, your games are not teaching tools in the sense that they offer nothing else. They're also remarkably clever and fun games to play. But that idea that we produce a knowledge community together and we co-construct an atmosphere together to support an ongoing self-actualization by the terms of cultural sovereignty of that group, I think is a kind of an extraordinarily powerful, I find extraordinary power in that way of being with others when learning. What I was trying to get back to that I couldn't because the dogs and cats interrupted is related to this in everything that you just said, because you started talking about a card game. And right now, particularly, I think, with the sort of explosion of games as an art form, as a critical tool, as AI becomes, I mean, there's a crazy article in the New York Times right now about AI. That's just kind of the tip of the iceberg of talking about, you know, the techno fetishism in play these days. It's so important to reel in the fact that like you're making games that are both like algorithms and also like a deck of cards. And that maybe sometimes the games aren't even a deck of cards, but are just bodies doing things together also. And that's like all the different atmospheres. It's like, that's a performativity of self, whether it's online or not online, with students or not with students, performing being a tenured faculty member, performing being a neurodivergent game maker, you know, like whatever it might be. I think it's a reason to admire your pathway of the kind of messiness there, because you've created a mechanism for yourself to operate in all those places simultaneously. I don't want to put any label on what all that means for you, but I kind of want to applaud your successful cleverness in doing that. Not to say that it's not genuine. I mean, I take it to be extraordinarily genuine, but it seems like that same level of composition, let's say, is at play in the specific games that you're making when you're doing what you said a moment ago, which is controlling the data set. In thinking about having this conversation with you, I didn't look at Objectif now, but I remember it from years ago when you presented at the Living Room Light Exchange, you talked about it. So I have a visual in my mind of what that is like. To continue framing who you are for the audience, the question revolves around the place that games aren't just digital. Let's discuss that.
It's funny because games are not the only thing that I make. And I've been thinking about this. So I am in one of the departments, performance, play, and design. That is a new department that was renamed. It was actually the theater arts department, and a merger with the theater arts department and the game design program at UC Santa Cruz. And when they sort of enveloped us, it was like, okay, you know, we don't want to just be theater arts and just have you feel like a sort of add-on, like, let's rename, let's re-envision. And I actually, okay, I think the name's too long, but whatever. What can you do, academia? But I actually really, it's starting to grow on me, this like performance, play, and design, because like the word game is not even in there. I feel like more and more I've been thinking about really what I'm working with is play, is playfulness. Because I do, I, especially early in my career, probably less so now, but I always wanted to make games and make a game. So every time I'd start a project, it'd be like, okay, how can this be a game? And games are really hard to make. So a lot of the times it was like, if you see a work that I created that isn't a game, it was like, oh yeah. What it turned out that a game is hard and that was too complicated. And so I had to scale down and think, well, does it have to take that form? Maybe I can just communicate this idea in a poster or a tweet or in a poem or in a glitch art or something like that. And I say that because when I focus on play, it's much more expansive. And I am always sort of using the tools of, I am always thinking like a game designer, right? Because I'm still always thinking about the environments, I'm thinking about the emotional outcome, the experiential outcome, and how to put all the pieces in place so that people will perform the actions, the physical and emotional actions to lead them to a certain like outcome. And I do think that that's in all of my work, that I'm just like, okay, what do I need to do for people to feel this thing? What levers do I press? So sometimes it's like you're pressing the button. Well, here's the thing about games. Games provide the illusion that you're pulling the lever and therefore you're having the experience and you're coming to the conclusion. Like you play a game like Objective or you play a game like Fairly Intelligent.Tech and you're like, wow, now I feel some type of way and I have these insights and yeah, this and that. And it's like, well, those aren't yours. Those aren't yours. I'm like an, you know, omnipotent God and you're in my palace of riddles. And I just, you know, that's how I feel like as a game designer, like that's the beautiful thing. But yeah, I don't know. Thinking more about play and I'm thinking about bell hooks again too, because these things are related, is that I'm never not working. It is very difficult for me to actually put up these like boundaries between like my professional and my personal life. Because I feel like every single thing that I do, and I very intentionally oriented my life around making art. So every experience, I mean, this is for any creative person, every experience is always feeding back into that. And I'm so kind of obsessive about that, that when I'm playing myself, like what I'm doing on Twitter right now is just kind of unhinged and necessary. And is this like playful thing that I'm doing because I'm like, this is going to teach me something. And if I go through this trial, right? Like if I go through this obstacle course, I'm going to figure something out that somebody else hasn't because they didn't walk over the hot coals or whatever it is. And I talk about that boundary there in some ways, which will be very relatable to any creative person. Like, well, of course, everything you're doing is, you know, feeding back into your creative work. But I think maybe a piece that isn't always there, especially for those of us who create and live with a certain politics, is that idea of the politics being personal or the politics like manifesting in your everyday life. And something I really appreciate about bell hooks, which was also in Teaching to Transgress, and it hit me at a time where I really needed to hear it, because I was feeling, especially in these times, you know, I was feeling really disillusioned. It's like, oh, I made it to the space, I've made it to academia, the people care about the right things, all that other nonsense, and I just felt so disappointed. And my life has often been going into a series of rooms and being like, oh, okay, I'm in this room and now I'm gonna be, and then I'm like, this room sucks, and I go to another room, and I just have kind of, this is like my path to success, is I just keep trying to find a better room. And it's like, well, yeah, I got a raise. I'm like, I still don't like it. I'm still complaining. There is a quote in that text that's essentially talking about, she calls out, she's like, how it bothers her, the idea that it is naive to take a moral position that like what we do in our day-to-day lives, what we practice should be fully in line with our politics, that we are the living embodiment of our politics. And that how in so many progressive circles, it's like, oh yeah, we're going to be activists with a capital A and we're going to write the books and we're going to be theorists. But I mean, what do you mean about that interaction I had with someone in my social circle? What do you mean about my day-to-day? Ah, oh, come on. That, and even now, kind of updated version of this is you'll hear, I've heard from people who are have names and platforms. And I'm like, what about that thing that you did though? Or what about this interaction we're having? That doesn't seem in alignment. I've heard, well, you know, these issues are structural. It's not about the individual. That's the new fallback. I can be an asshole because I'm just an individual. And I'm just like, taking off my glasses for this audience. I'm going to rub my temples here because I'm like, you know, social systems are constituted of people and we uphold them. So I get that it's not on any one individual, but a system is a collection of individuals. And I think we all kind of have to be working together to make that system function in new and different ways, which is all to say, when I hear that, I'm just upset and I'm sad, but bell hooks always has my back. To bring it all the way back around to the digital and the card games and these other things. Like, I love what you said, just bodies together in a room or minds together on the internet in a virtual room, right? It is important to me that I'm able to figure out in all of the spaces that I inhabit what it means to play well. You catch that Bernie DeKoven reference, the well-played game. This is a very short book that if you're not into games at all, I actually recommend reading, because it's a book about designing games that is not talking from the designer's perspective, which is so how we focus. I think this is really relatable to tech and some of the problems we see in tech, where it's so much as, you know, we think of ourselves as the experts. And so the books are written to each other, like the other makers. The Well Played Game is beautiful because it is written focusing on the player's perspective. It is a playfully written book. It is a book that talks directly to you as the reader, as a participant in the experience of consuming the book. It seems so silly and unserious in a way. Like it doesn't seem scholarly. It seems like reading this book, because it's so easy as well to read. So easy. The more and more I reflect on that book, the more I'm just like, that was absolutely brilliant and radical and such an interesting choice to say, wait a minute, it's not about designing the perfect game. It's not about designing the perfect rules. It's about how it feels in the moment to be playing with another person and kind of screw the rules. If the rules need to change dynamically in the moment, if we are playing tennis together and one of us has less experience, well, then what if we make a new rule to equal that out? Because it's about how does it feel while we're together? And what could be more important than that?
That's beautiful. That's world building towards cultural sovereignty, I think. A quote that drives a lot of the way that I think is from the jazz musician Chewbacca Hutchings. And it is, communities that have agency are capable of forming their own philosophical structures. Mm. And this feels like that to me. This also is recognizing a complex relationship with authorship and individualism that seems too frequently under-addressed in our highly individualist capitalist society that we live in all parts of society, but, you know, particularly in the context of academia, where the pathway towards success is still a highly individualist, highly capitalist ethos of publishing papers, making work, individual accolades that are often done under the banner of Marxism or some other type of critical engagement that is presumably anti-capitalist or an alternative framework. I'm just kind of taking a moment to kind of reflect on that outcome, because I mean, where else is it other than in the experience that a game resides also? I mean, I'm not a game maker. I am an artist. I make many things. I have complex relationships with audiences as well, and I don't make things that are necessarily rendered clear. People understand me most when I describe myself as an experimental media artist. That doesn't mean they understand what I do, but they accept me in their pantheon of thought in that description. There's this way of being with people that you experienced to some extent with the Light Exchange a handful of years ago that I have forever struggled with how to describe as a practice, which is making situations happen together. I don't want to describe it as a curatorial process because that is too individualist. In that way of game making that you were describing, it displaces all of that onto someone other than yourself, but includes you in it. I want to ask you a question about, we've managed to spend about 15 minutes talking, and I've asked you two of the questions that I actually planned on asking you. And I want to ask you about the open source Afro Hair Library, because that is in orbit of what we're talking about right now. So I want to read something from your website that talks about your intent behind the open source Afro Hair Library to bring that into the fold of where we're at right now.
You're just reminding me that I really need to update my website, because every time you say that, I'm like, oh Lord, I'm like, which version? I'm like, have I looked at that? But anyway, I'm on the edge of my seat because I have no idea what you're going to say. I love this for me.
You say, there is a limited representation of Black people in games and digital media. In real life, natural Black hair is considered a liability in academic and professional settings, with Black people being subject to loss of employment, school suspension, or even having our hair forcibly removed before being allowed to compete as athletes. across digital media, accurate and diverse depictions of Black hairstyles and textures are generally confined to NBA sports video games, but even that representation is only of Black male players. Outside of these basketball video games, Black people, regardless of gender, are often portrayed in ways that are derogatory, inaccurate, stereotypical, demeaning, and otherwise harmful if they are depicted at all. Please share with us what the Open Source Afro Hair Library is. And I'm bringing it up now because I think it does kind of challenge this idea of what a game digital intervention is a bit. And I think it's an utterly amazing intervention, but also it's really just a tool.
So I'm still taking a moment because I'm just like listening to you read that. And we had this discussion about whose voice and like what that our different embodiments. So I was like, yeah, that sounds great. When you read it like that, I'm like, I would have given that person tenure. She sounds amazing.
You did that.
Like, that was me.
You got that.
It's the summer. And so I just kind of turned all of my brain off. I was like, oh, that's what I was doing. Great. Hope I get that back. So about OSAL, or the Open Source Afro Hair Library, very long name. So we actually just wrapped the second season, as I've been calling them, of the fellowship program. So let me back up and explain it. So the Open Source Afro Hair Library is a queer feminist, I used to say anti-racist, but I have tenure now, so I can just say pro-Black database of Afro textures, 3D models of Afro textures and styles. You know, I'm focusing on hair because hair is, you know, a political site for Black bodies, but I really, it's kind of it's an entry point for me to think about Black virtuality, which is, I'm not the first person to say that term, but I think the first person said it 12 years ago, wasn't talking about what I'm talking about. So, you know, I'm running with it. But really thinking about the construction and consumption of Black culture, Black bodies, and Black identity in virtual space. And of course, you know, I'm talking about virtual space, but really I've been thinking about the entanglement that's so clear in my life, but I think is becoming, has been clear there to me, because I'm a person who grew up on the internet, as you can see in my work, the snark factor. But because of the pandemic, it has been rendered more clearly and made more legible to more people how intertwined the virtual and corporeal are, how they reinforce each other. You know, it wasn't even that long ago, 2014, where it was still people saying, you know, things that happen on the internet aren't real, comments aren't real. And I was like, oh, we could have, some women in video games in particular, some Black women could have told you about what was going to happen with the 2016 election. Saw that coming. Right. So now we're starting to realize that's real. And then the pandemic, it's like, well, everything's on Zoom and your background is changed. And if we Zoom right now, and I try to clip out my background. So for those who can't see, I have curly hair. Zoom cannot screen out those curls. It's going to give me some weird mullet. Right. So again, my legibility, my Blackness is edited out because of the dependency on the mediated existence that we have for me to like show up to work, for example. And it's funny because in that line, I talk about the Black hair being deemed unprofessional. One of the words that used to be used very often is like polish, like looking more polished, that if you had, you know, straight hair, non-kinky hair. And so many, you know, Black folks, you know, you get your straight hair to go to work, especially if you're going to be, you know, like, I think the example of someone getting fired was a television anchor. And I remember a television anchor wearing her braids for the first time on air and all of these things. So it was like, you know, to have the polished look, you have your polished makeup, you have your press suit, and you have that straight hair. And it's really easy to be like, now to be like, well, of course, that's not acceptable. That doesn't make sense. You know, we're in this movement now where it's like, Black hair is beautiful, da da da. But in 2022, if I get on Zoom, my colleagues with straight hair who are not Black get to be presented as more polished because that is how the technology has mediated them. Okay, I have ADHD. What was the question? What were we talking about?
The Open Source Black Hair Library.
Thank you. So thinking about OSAL, the way that this project came about was I was doing a VR project and I needed to create a bunch of avatars, and I'm not a 3D modeler. So I was creating these avatars using existing tools. which are basically like video game character creators. They're very similar to that, where it's like you've got some parameters, you're tweaking some knobs and dials to try to get unique looking characters. And it was mostly working. It was like, I think I've had pieces where it's like 20 different characters, and it was kind of like a personal narrative piece. So I was soliciting people's experiences in public space, how you navigate public space based on the body that you inhabit. And so like the avatars I was creating needed to resemble the aesthetics of the people. Not, it didn't have to be built around them because everyone was anonymous, but it had to, it's like if I was moving through the world, we had one person talking about going to a Celtic festival because they love Celtic music and they're a Black woman, and what that looks like and what that feels like, the gazes that they get and the looks and the sense that, wait, what are you doing? You here? And so, you know, I'm having to create avatars. I was like, okay, well, I need to, the avatar has to be a Black woman, you know, with some skin tone, certain hair texture. If I just make a Black woman who's, you know, kind of looks light skin, ethnically ambiguous, that's not going to communicate the story. So I made these 20 characters. They were looking so good. They all felt very unique. I was like, oh, wow, I'm so brilliant. Great. Love technology, media art. And then the hair, there were like, I think 17 styles, and like only one of them was explicitly kinky hair. And what do you think it was? One of the same three we always get, which is like locks, also known as dreadlocks. And I won't get into the connotation of that term, but so you have locks, they're unstyled. There's like hair that's on, matted hair on top of the head. And I'm like, okay, well, I can't just have all the Black characters have the same three looks. So I go on to these really easily accessible marketplaces, like these 3D asset marketplaces. And I'm searching for Black hair. And, you know, you can go to my website or read about this work to know kind of the query process, because that's its own issue. But ultimately what I came away with, once I went through the several steps it took, iterations on that search to actually find any kind of Black hair, there's something about going through a process of looking for yourself and seeing in a marketplace, grids of Black bodies in a T pose, all standing there, like really a market, like, gee, I wonder what that reminds me of. Or seeing disembodied parts, like you can go on these markets and search and just see, like, here's a pack of Black feet, Black hands. And it starts to reinforce that sense of like, I am a commodity. And I've been a commodity before. So I'm very aware of like, oh, this doesn't feel good. It's an Afro hair library. It is a resource. It is, one could say it's a utility. But I'm really trying to push back against that, because I don't want people to go to this website, download a Black body, and then put it somewhere. What I wanted to do by creating a separate space, so yes, I'm creating the hairstyles, and a first question, if you're familiar with this, might be, well, you can create the hairstyles, and then you can put them in these databases, and that adds diversity, representation. But because I went through that process of seeing Black bodies on the marketplace being bought and sold, I was like, you know what? Going back to this idea of ownership and capitalism, what does it look like to create Blackness as part of a tool or a resource without having a proprietary relationship to it? You know, what does it mean? Like, what is an alternative to a marketplace? You know, I don't want to see Black bodies bought and sold by, like, you know, these presumably white folks who own these corporations. But is it better if I just become the Black person who's buying and selling the Black bodies? Like, or if I'm creating the marketplace, like I'm the Black owned marketplace, you know, like I'm like, no. So I really wanted to develop a resource and a community. I am actively designing a site. So it's like the models are like the draw. It's like, oh, this is going to be beautiful and you're going to come to the site. But the site is intentionally not designed to be easy to use in the typical optimal way that UX designers would want, where it's like, you know, if you think about some of the basic, and this is going to come back to Sophia Noble. If you think about designing a site, there's some pretty clear goals that you want. Usually it's like, you want someone to be able to go to your site and find what they're looking for and get what they're looking for as quickly as possible. Kind of a basic premise of like shopping and whatnot, except for the grocery store that breaks the whole metaphor. So ignore that. But I am trying to rope you in. I don't want you to be able to come to OSOL and then extract Blackness and leave. I want you to have to kind of learn Blackness and become intimate with Blackness and understand it just through the process of navigating the website. So for example, there's no search bar on OSAL. You cannot just search for black hair and then find what you're looking for. And this is why I say this goes back to Sophia Noble. So Sophia Noble wrote the book Algorithms of Oppression. And it started with, I think about a decade ago, she was doing Google search. She did a Google search for black girls because she was entertaining some actual literal black children that she was watching. And black girls returned all of these pornographic results. Why? Because the search algorithm, it's a populist algorithm. The way that Google search worked at that time, and mostly still works as I understand it, is that, you know, you search for results, you send in a query, and then whatever you are clicking on, that starts to raise it in ranking. So if I search for black girls and I'm finding pictures of little cute black girls in pigtails, and like so are a million other people, and that's what we click on, then that's what's going to be the top of the results. That's what's going to populate Google image search, right? Because there's not necessarily someone overseeing that. It's just like, well, what's popular must be what's good. And that's how we help people find what they're looking for. Now, one of the problems of being a minority is that every single black person could be searching for cute little melanated girls with pigtails. But if 80% of the other users are searching for some kind of fetish, some kind of pornographic interpretation of black girl, because that's what they think of when they think of black girl, which is not a child at all, but is the infantilization of a grown woman for sexual pleasure and arousal. Well, what is Google in its, you know, neutral, scare quotes again, in its neutral mechanism going to do? Well, it's going to surface those results first. But what happens is you end up with an algorithm that allows people outside of a community to determine the definition of that community, to define the term. Because black girl no longer means innocent child, it means for your consumption. So if you apply that to black hair, for example, this goes back to the query. If you apply that to black hair and look at these marketplaces, well, what I found is you weren't even finding black people. You were finding comical afros. You were finding, you know, clearly Caucasian characters with really jacked up hair that was like almost clownish. You were finding like half the results were animals, right? So then you get to determine that. You get to determine the language. Like for black people, we just call our hair black hair. But suddenly I'm on these marketplaces and I have to figure out, well, what is a non-black person? What would they call me? How do they see me? Would they know kinky hair, afro hair, right? Like I have to find myself in it through another's gaze, and that doesn't feel good. All of this is to say this massive project that is about, starts with aesthetics, has all of these layers about the structure and how to make this a space that's accessible to black people primarily, obviously, but also for non-black folks. Like if you take away a search bar, think about the other ways you can navigate. The system I'm using is tags. So right now it's still in flux, but I'm using like, I can start with like the Walker hair typing system, which was augmented basically by black community online. It used to be three types. Now there's four, which captures the kinkiest, there were four types, but it didn't capture all hair types. And it just didn't capture the nuance between kinky hair types. That was something that black women largely had to add to the system later through sites like Naturally Curly and stuff like that. These community message board sites of shared knowledge, which are responsible for like the natural hair movement. So starting with like the Walker system, you can say, well, I'm looking for type 4A hair or type 4C hair. And these are kinky curly styles. Or you can say, I can go style. I can say, you're looking for a twist out. You're looking for braids. You're looking for Bantu knots. And I can have these different tags. So black people already know what that is and can easily find what they're looking for. But if you're not black, because you cannot search for the stereotype, because I don't want to give you what you're looking for, because what you're looking for is limited and maybe racially inept, racially ignorant, culturally ignorant, just by using that navigation, you have to learn, oh, what is type four? Oh, this is what Bantu knots are. And this really goes back to, again, me saying I'm always thinking like a game designer, because I'm always thinking about how do I create the structure and the incentive to know what I want you to know.
I really appreciate you explaining that. I was very curious to know when you said you didn't want it to only be thought of as a tool. You didn't say only, but that you didn't want it to be a space where blackness would be extracted, even if it were being made by a Black person. You're right. I mean, that's like designing an experience that's an ongoing learning experience of at trying to describe it at all. You just did that.
No, but you know what it is? I mean, I thought of that and I explained it in that way. And thank you for giving me the opportunity and the prompting, because you were talking about community. And this is what I was thinking about. What's the difference between a marketplace? What's the difference between being a resource and giving information versus like being a utility? Because utility just feels like that's just functional. That's just something you need to get what you're getting and you go. But a resource, and this is why it's the library, because I think library is like one of the last institutions that we have. I'm just like, they're just pure good. They're full of books. They're free. They also are services for like the community. A library is there to serve the people that go to the library, and they will expand and they will shift based on that, as opposed to being a static entity. And then you have to be a certain kind of person to be there. And so that is what I think about with OSOL. I'm like, a library is a space where people come together for different purposes who across social strata, but they have to share that space. And the library, it doesn't just adapt to the community, it adapts in a pro-social way. I think libraries are really great at adapting in a non-exclusionary way, because it's not like, well, we're going to have tiers of membership because we have, it's like, no, we're just free and you don't need free books, but you're here and we're going to do a community workshop and you can bring your kids and you can, I really just love that. And so to me, it's again, well, we can have different rules, and I don't want to own Blackness, which is also why what I was saying is that we just finished up a fellowship, and the way that the models are created is through a fellowship program that I run where, you know, I'm working with Black 3D artists. We get together, you know, we all meet together and we talk about it. We make progress. Everybody comes up with a theme. So again, it's not, we need this and you need to make these Black folks because this is the Blackness that, you know, the mainstream society needs to have in their game or whatever. It's like, hey, what does it look like if you give Black folks the resources, both the social resources and the financial resources and just the time to author our own depictions of us, right? Like, what does that look like? Let's do that. And then it's not me just being from my Black American perspective saying, well, this is the definition of Blackness. It's like, well, I have some thoughts. What are your thoughts? And we don't even have to agree about it. We can talk about it. We can work through that. There's one word I want to mention because I was thinking about it earlier. And I think it's really important to this idea of games and play. We're talking about play and playing well and all this stuff in politics. But something that is really missing that I've been working on and thinking about is conflict. We are terrible at allowing for and resolving conflict in our digital spaces. We have still not figured out how to do that well. I find myself at this stage in my work, and this is, I think, afforded by tenure in a lot of ways, because I don't have an answer. It's like, do I write a book? I'll probably write a book about this, honestly. I think that's where I'm going. Conflict is so scary because we're trying to not get anything wrong, always. And there's such social consequences. You know, it's like cancel culture isn't real unless you're a marginalized person. But as a marginalized person, I'm like, oh, can I actually say that? Can I actually do that? It's like, I really need to... This goes back to me saying why we should keep some of the hiccups in the podcast, right? It's like, well, it's not just about showing that I make mistakes or mistakes are okay or whatever. It's about the permission to not get things right. It's about the permission to be in process and to be able to move through that and not be held to, well, remember the time, you know, and with us, it's like, oh, a dog got in the room. But sometimes it's like, I said something that, not me, everyone. I said something that was socially problematic. But it's like, well, yeah, my mom says some socially problematic things, but guess what? She was a Black woman who struggled and did some things. It doesn't make it okay, but I think we can have a little grace, because what community is actually us caring about each other and knowing we're in different places and going to that workshop together. And like, we don't have that now. And I think what I've been really careful to do with OSOL is be like, I cannot occupy my position of authority, my position of respectability, my position of checkbox, 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 degrees and tenure and all of that to then be the sole author of Blackness. And I don't want that responsibility. So let's bring everyone in. And I have artists, I work with artists across the diaspora, across the globe. And it really feels good to know that there is not just space for the affirmation that comes with being in an all Black space, but what it means to know that you could have messy conversations and get some things wrong and actually go in places because you're not held to the standard of, well, everyone's watching us. So what does it mean for us if they're watching and we get it wrong? It's like, I don't care about that. Let's figure it out.
it makes me think back to the third way as well. Ruha's third way, that in so many environments is not afforded as building structures to reinterpret what meaning itself is not something that dominant white America or European history is very good at accepting in all domains of culture, I think. We've gone a bit over, and something that I like about that is that since this is a podcast that isn't bound by commercial radio, it doesn't really matter. these like weird historical media grooves that we must have programs of 30-minute increments to allow for advertisements and whatnot. But we do need to wrap up. The last bit that you were sharing about the library also reminded me of what I felt like is a really important question. There's like two kind of closing questions that I want to ask you, which is actually three, because two of them are about questions I ask everyone on this program. We've been talking about it throughout, but we barely even got to the directness of the way that you kind of challenge ideas of inclusivity in your work, and the ways that you talk about, both in Yay and Nay, the game about Kanye, the game where half of the characters are Kanye, and also in the Fairly Intelligent Algorithm, you're making these really funny, but very, very critical observations about inclusivity in a multicultural context in one sense, and then also like the distinction of like having icons, but then seeing them not live up to expectation in another context. And you're really like, unforgiving isn't the right way to say it, because you're being like performatively unforgiving. You're really challenging something that I think is extraordinarily important.
It's not, it's a Black thing. This to me is a very deeply Black American thing. The dozens, like you go, we learn in elementary school how to take criticism and to stand up. To me, it's roasting. I did this to my student, by the way. Roasting is a fundamental feature of my work, because I'm like, to me, a roast is with love. Like even the commercial version, you know, the Comedy Central roast. It's like, you roast. A roast is a tribute. Yay or Nay is a tribute to Kanye, someone who I adore and who is wildly out of pocket. But you know why I adore him? Because if you play the game, one of the characters is bluest eye Kanye. I haven't had the heart. I've drawn this, or my artist has drawn this, and I've written for this, but there's a MAGA version of Kanye that I have not put in the game because I just haven't been able to do it. He's wearing the hat and I'm like, I can't do it. But the reason I made it that game is not for MAGA Kanye. It's for Kanye who said, George Bush doesn't care about Black people, which was one of the most powerful and radical things I've ever seen a person do, especially a rising celebrity who didn't have a lot of power. So I think like that roast is like, I am critical with love. My criticism comes from a place. I had my chair actually say this recently, because I was been very critical. Anyone who knows me, I'm very critical of institutions that I'm at. I've always been that way. So now I'm very critical of UC Santa Cruz. But my chair said to me recently, he said, and he is a very sweet person, he said, I've learned that when you are critical, that is a sign of trust. And that is true, because I'm not critical of things that I think are hopeless or stupid or people that I don't respect. I'm critical because in my heart, I'm like, I know your capacity and potential. I'm critical of the world and society because I really love people. So I'm like, why are you always getting on my nerves? Come on, let's go. Come on, let's do better.
I mean, I think out of that comes something extraordinarily genuine. And that's something you are extraordinarily good at, is being genuine in public, maybe, like on the internet, in the sense that like the internet is a public space. Mm-hmm. Because there's such a lack of genuineness, like even genuineness becomes commodified on the internet. And so finding a way to actually be legible as being genuine is so hard.
And you have to keep changing it, because it's like, yeah, Wendy's is genuine. The brand is genuine now. And so it's like, that's what I mean about it. So I have to actively be myself, because also who I am gets taken and sold back to me. And then you learn to, or you get the positive feedback of people going, wow, you're so genuine. And then you start playing to that. And so you're like, wait, what am I doing? Yeah, it's a whole thing. But I want to ask, what are your three questions?
Yeah. So, well, there's two now, because that one was the one about destroying your icons and inclusivity. I ask everyone on this podcast to ask a question to the next guest. That's because this podcast has a wide range of guests. And the whole point of it is to create an atmosphere where there can be a public-facing, a fairly accessible conversation around what technocultures is and what technocultural exchange might be like. Knowing that there's a range of folks who come onto this show, I would love to know what question you would ask to the next guest and why that question is important.
Yeah, I have a question, and it's even more specific than that. It's a request. I want to ask, when is the last time you experienced pleasure? And I don't want to know what that activity was or the act was. I want people to experience pleasure and then think about what that felt like and then tell me what that felt like. And again, I don't want to know what the pleasure was, in part because, again, I want the freedom of it to be anything. I don't want the self-consciousness. I don't want the, like, whether it was hours or a second or whatever it is. And I want the beautiful potential privacy of that, whether it was a moment with a leaf or a person or whatever. I just want people to remember and really sit with what it felt like and then to articulate it and share it with me. What did it feel like when you experienced that pleasure? So that's my request and that's my question. And why that matters, I know that this isn't fully articulated yet, because the culmination of all of these experiences I've been having, these experiments, this anti-performance work I've been doing, this realization that I'm autistic, all of the stuff that's been happening in my world that has allowed me to be more authentic just because I've been able to know myself better. I often think that I think the fundamental limitation that I have about the world in this particular society, American society to an extreme, but it's also kind of become a global thing. It feels like that there is an expectation in the United States in particular for a baseline level of suffering. Everyone must suffer. Suffering is a virtue, and it is an expectation upon which society is expected to function. It is presented to us as a necessity. Suffering is imposed upon us without our consent, and we are told that it is a virtue to be proud of. This is why the student loan stuff and everything else, this is why the way that you get accommodations in our society, even accommodations themselves, it's like, well, have you suffered enough? Have you met the threshold of suffering? Okay, then we'll give you a little lever to pull. Really, really messed up. So I was like, okay, so I kind of knew that for a few years. I was like, this is messed up, but what do we do about it? It was the first time I started thinking about what is the opposite of suffering. And as someone who has suffered a lot in my life, I just don't want to suffer. Just the absence of that, or being happy or what, but I hadn't really, the opposite of suffering is pleasure. And I think the solution to these structures in our world is getting back to pleasure. And literally this week, I was like, oh, we live in a society that has made suffering a virtue and has made pleasure a vice. We have made pleasure something that is policed, honestly, that is legislated, that is considered oftentimes like some kind of moral failing. You have to like prove and justify that your pleasure is the right kind of pleasure. And I was like, pleasure is something that is one, like a fundamental cosmic good, like just being in the body. And when you demonize pleasure in that way, it makes it so much easier to separate body and mind and to keep you in your head while our bodies are labor. Our bodies are just constantly being used for stuff. And it's like, wait, what? No. So I think I'm starting to understand how the demonization of pleasure and that being looked at as like a kind of base thing to feel that needs to be justified and all of these things and can be considered uncivilized or animalistic or whatever, whatever. That demonization of pleasure is necessary to uphold so many oppressive systems. And I didn't realize that until recently.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. Thank you for that. A friend of mine, Prabha Pilar, who's a performance artist, diasporic Colombian, on participating in consensus-based co-op meetings in Oakland, said to me once, where's the joy? I appreciate you sharing all of that a lot. it's kind of amazing that you asked that question and framed it that way, because now what I'm going to do is ask you the question that my last guest asked, and we'll end after that. And that guest was M. Effler, who goes by Blink Pop Shift, who is a queer disabled VR and AR artist. M asked, how do disabled people and disability factor into your future? And what accommodations do you need, even if you don't identify as disabled? And they ask this from the perspective that everybody needs something, and M wants to know what that is, particularly because this is what M is saying from disability in the world of disability research. There is a lot of time spent defining and taxonomizing who is disabled enough, who gets access to things, who gets accommodation, who gets medication, how much. And instead of thinking like that, this is what M said specifically. There are more people that would talk about the things that they need. The more we can move away from people who are able-bodied, who don't need any help ever, and people who are disabled that need all of this help and are special. So I'll ask you the question again. How do disabled people and disability factor into your sense of the future? And what accommodations do you need?
So I need a minute, because I mean, it really literally brought tears to my eyes, like, because it's so timely for me. Caveat, like, I feel like disability justice is something that I don't know about. Like, I feel like that wouldn't be my wheelhouse. That's something I would defer, you know, and I'm speaking like as a professor or a scholar, like, oh, that's not my knowledge base. And yet I feel like everything I've been doing this summer has been through a lived experience, really understanding, informing my own thoughts and understanding my own relationship to disability. So I'm going to say something that's maybe like wildly out of pocket and provocative. I don't believe in disabled people. I don't think that that's real. And what I mean by that is that society disables. We live in a society that has decided that certain bodies, ways of being, ways of thinking, ways of appearing, ways of inhabiting are more useful under capitalism, create less friction, fit more neatly, are more streamlined. And I noticed this in social media, because I'm like, you know, social media is really just incentivizing us to limit ourselves so that we can fit more easily into targetable demographics to be advertised to. Like, that's one. There are other things, but like, it's that simple and that kind of grotesque, right? There's not even necessarily a nefarious plan. It's like, well, when you have 8 different checkboxes, I don't know what kind of shampoo to sell you, but if I can just force you to even self-select into one, I know what podcast you should listen to. I know what ethical brand of soap to sell you. And it's like, oh, wow, that's how lovely. So something I do in my classes is that if any person, this was before I was really deeply thinking about this, but if any person submitted an accommodation request, I made it universal for the whole class. Because I'm like, that's how that should work. Everything that's possible to help someone should be there. So that's what I mean about like society disables. I don't really think there are disabled people. I think that we all come in these different configurations. Everybody needs support. And what if we reoriented that? And this would be my accommodation request. The accommodation I need is to literally dismantle this entire structure and live in a world where you don't have to qualify for support based on some weird means testing, that we just ask what makes you feel safe. And we constantly negotiate that in communities. Like, it's literally that simple. Like, what do you need to feel safe? What do you need to have access? What do you need to feel joy and pleasure? And not this other BS thing that we do. It's like, well, what do you need to have your bare minimum life things met? Oh, you need to eat. Why is that? It's always like just to survive. I don't want to survive. Like, my birthright was more than survival. Like, even when my lifespan was shorter and it was like, you know, millennia ago, it's like I had air and fruit and there were moments of beauty and joy and pleasure in the body. And I got to have those. I didn't have to justify having them. what can we all have to have a pleasurable life? So I'm gonna end with this because I wanted to say it, but then I kind of forgot. Something that I have learned so much about in terms of games and play and all this stuff that I'm talking about is really I'm talking about consent. And where I learned consent was from play parties. For people to know what play parties are, another word for them is orgies or bacchanals, whatever you want to call them. The ones that I attend are specifically referred to as play parties because of specifically avoiding the expectation for like sexual intimacy, that it is just a space to be safe. And what I realized was that what I like about play parties is that they are safe for me because everything is explicit. So this goes into the accommodation. The rules are stated explicitly. It is not a game of inference. We're talking about safety. We're talking about the body. I have, you know, SA trauma. I've experienced these things. And it's like, finally, I was in a place where I could say, where boundaries were not about things that people crossed or ways of keeping people out, but boundaries were ways of letting people in. Boundaries were things that you could negotiate with someone. You could just say something as simple as, you know what I would like is I would like a hug. And that hug doesn't sign me up to a newsletter of like a certain kind of intimacy that maybe I didn't want or wasn't comfortable with, right? It wasn't, well, we cuddle now and that means we're going to get this other thing. And not just for me, but for others. I could receive exactly what I felt I needed and I could give. I was given the opportunity to show up for other people with what they needed. And when I think about disability and I think about accommodation and I think about the world that I want to live in, I want to live in a world where we are not playing a game of inference that is predicated on I'm trying to get the thing I want and you're trying to get the thing you want, but we can't explicitly say that because I have to trick you into giving me the thing while making you feel like you're getting the thing. No, I just want to be able to say like, hey, I want to be able to fully inhabit my yeses and fully inhabit my nos. And I don't just mean in sexual context. I mean, in every context. I mean, when I go to work and I feel like because I'm neurodivergent, somebody's saying something that's unclear, and I want to ask for clarification that I'm not going to get, you're being rude, or you know what you're doing, or you know what that means, or this is obvious, or that's common sense. I don't want any of that. I just want to be able to say, actually, this is how my brain and body function. This is what makes me feel like I can thrive. This is what makes me feel safe. Maybe some of those things are in conflict with you, but let's talk about it. Let's build. That to me is world building. And that is the accommodation that I feel like I really need.
I'm without words for how much I've enjoyed this conversation. So thank you for the last hour and 15 minutes or so. We're like significantly over time and I have the duty now of figuring out how to make that work. Leave in the messy parts. I thought it was important to have an hour long podcast because some conversations need to play themselves out. Thank you for playing this conversation out with me. For everyone who's listening, you can go to AM Dark's website, which is Pretty Dark. That's PrettyDarke.cool, COOL, to see yay and nay.
Yay or nay.
Yay or nay. Thank you. Yay or nay. The outcome of being censored but not censored on Snapchat. information about the fairly intelligent algorithm. All manner of other work. Professor Dark, AM Dark, thanks.
Thank you.
Once again, my name is Elia Vargas. The Signals podcast is a project by the Goethe Institute in collaboration with Gray Area and the Sea Change Initiative. Signals is a monthly podcast released with the Signals digital magazine at seachange.xyz/signals. Until next time.